What I Believe was the title of two separate essays by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the novelist E.M. Forster in the early 20th century. These two humanist activists set out their approach to life, their fundamental worldview, in a way that was accessible to all. I'm Andrew Copson, Chief Exec of Humanists UK, and in this podcast I'm talking to humanists today about what they believe, to understand more about the values, convictions and opinions they live by.
Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Today I'm speaking with Humanists UK President Adam Rutherford, geneticist, writer, broadcaster and recipient of the Royal Society David Attenborough Award for Public Engagement with Science. Adam is the author of a large number of books, including the Sunday Times bestseller How to Argue with a Racist and his most recent book Control, The Dark History and Troubling Present of Eugenics. You'll have heard him presenting BBC Radio 4 programmes Inside Science, Start the Week and with Hannah Fry, The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry. Adam Rutherford, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
Hello, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
I thought we'd start with science because you are, I understand, a scientist. And this goes along usually with a certain number of beliefs and values and at least motivations. What was it that first got you interested in this pursuit?
Science? It was a random walk. I wandered into it. I was interested in everything at school and spent most of my time playing sport and playing music. And I come from a somewhat medical family. And back in the 90s, the mid-90s, it was easy to get into medicine. And so I just figured I would do that because that seems like a decent thing to do. But on arrival at medical school, discovered that I really had no interest in being a doctor. So I finished the year, but the only lectures that I really enjoyed were genetics, which were taught by Steve Jones, who's a friend of the humanists.
Oh, yeah.
As we both know. And I got to the end of the year, handed in my notice as a first-year undergraduate.
Sounds very grand. Yeah.
And I tried to transfer to first psychology. No, that's not true. First to classics, because that was my best subject at school, Latin. But they wouldn't take me because I only had half an A-level in Latin. And then I tried to transfer to psychology. My dad's a psychologist and they wouldn't take me because my grades weren't good enough. So good enough for medicine, but not psychology. And so then I thought, well, maybe I'll give genetics a go. And I've been a geneticist since then, 1994. Worked out okay, I think.
Well, that's a very diffident sort of explanation. But what was really the reason that genetics was attractive to you? What was it about it?
It is the most fundamental aspect of all biology. And I think I joined at a time which was quite lucky in that it was just after, I came up to university just after the beginning of the Human Genome Project. So we were in this golden age where suddenly humankind had decided that we were going to crack the entire code of humans. And so I sort of grew through that period and then into the 2000s when I started doing my PhD in genetics. And it was a similar period, a sort of golden age. And one of the key things that was happening at that time is we were realizing how little we know. So all of the confidence of the past about how genes worked and how evolution worked was being not so much swept away, but undergoing major reformation. And I really liked that. It was landing in a field where there were many more questions than answers and a lot of excited people trying to do what I think are the most important questions in science, which are about human origins and disease and inheritance. And particularly where I've sort of ended up is the relationship between history as a discipline and biology, which is often underplayed in understanding history, and culture. And that's been my trajectory there. So it's really just been about trying to understand life on Earth from an evolutionary and cultural point of view.
So you're interested in finding things out, but you're really specifically interested in humans.
Not necessarily over other biology, because evolution applies to all organisms. And my
history and culture and the intersection of all these things in which you're interested, and you know, your classical sympathies and everything else. It always seems to me that, you know, the human being is your real field of interest.
That is certainly true, because we are the most interesting of animals.
I did start
working on the stork-eyed fly, which I will still have a deep passion for. And I think when people go through that period where they decide to revert to their first loves, it will be Cercopithecus dalmani for me. But anyway, yes, you're quite right, though. Why are we the most interesting species? Well, because we have largely unshackled ourselves from the constraints of evolution and the constraints of natural selection. And we have unloaded much of our programming from hardware into software. So outside of our genetics and outside of our bodies, and now all of our cultural evolution, all of our evolution really has happened in the last 50,000 years in social situations, in the spaces between us, in our minds, and in the development of us as a social organism. And that makes it a much harder scientific question to answer, but a much more interesting set of questions to ask.
Why are you interested in classics?
Well, the more, I don't need to tell you this as a classicist.
No, I know. I want to hear why you didn't
The more you read and understand the classics, the more you realize that everything's already happened and it's been done better and written better and more interestingly than almost everyone writing after that period.
Is that just a joke, or do you really feel that? Do you think that the long story of humanity actually has had brighter chapters than this?
I think it's a semi-joke. I think there is a great deal of truth in that. I think there is a strong element of truth, the universal truths of story, which continue to inform all of our culture and all of our stories today, which I'm fundamentally interested in. But also many of the ideas that are fundamental to science are also rooted in the classics. I also like the fact that they got a lot of shit wrong as well. So, you know, people get really, really excited about how significant Aristotle was in the development of biology and various other of the classical scholars who set up what is broadly referred to as Western civilization, which I'm a little bit iffy about. And it's fun to go back through those texts, because most people who teach you, most people who write about this stuff, most of our great thinkers today, they really only read the Wikipedia pages. And all this stuff is available to read, and it's really easy and often well written.
I think it's more than this with you. I think that you've got you've bought into a pretty grand vision of the human story. Your writing has reflected that.
I am a terrible sentimentalist, and yes, I'm a terrible optimist, and I do believe in the great achievements of humankind. I take the sort of Carl Sagan line, which is that we are special, we are capable of such greatness and also such horrors. But that the punchline, the conclusion to that sentence in Contact is that the only place that we don't feel alone is with each other. And I enjoy that immensely. And that does inform my humanism. That is a sort of central tenet of the way I think about humankind, that we work best as teams, we work best together, and we work best when we share and play nicely. Science is the sort of epitome of that. There is an element of competition in science, but really everything works much better if we go slowly and hold hands.
That's one of the reasons that you engage in it as a discipline, I suppose, because that's the sort of person you are.
It's very collegial.
Yeah.
I find I'm mostly right now. So I spend about half my time teaching at UCL and about half my time writing books, and the other half of my time doing Radio 4. And writing is very solitary, and I don't really like it. And I spend a lot of time writing, when I'm writing, talking to other people and asking people to read things, and just, I find that my books are team efforts. I know that some writers, and this is not a criticism, are very solitary and refuse to be edited. The words that get published for me with my name on the front cover tend to be words that are effectively team efforts.
Does your study of science throw any light on this? I mean, on this aspect of human nature, the idea that that a lot of our achievements are collective, that what important to us are relationships with each other. I mean, I've always wondered about that. Is there anything that science says about that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we think we evolved in groups. We evolved with selection occurring not at a group level, but amongst groups, because there's the complex and technical and controversial area of evolutionary biology, which I don't want to get into right now. But the fact that we exist in the modern family structure is a very modern invention, but over the last 50 to 100,000 years or so, our strength has been in groups. And indeed, a big part of work that originally came out of my department, but that I helped popularize in one of my books, was the key notion that the singular thing that really distinguishes us from other organisms is that we teach. We teach all the time. We are a species of expert and teachers. There isn't another organism that has such talents, which are so widely distributed amongst them. So you're an expert in a bunch of stuff. I'm an expert in a bunch of stuff. If your car breaks down, right, who do you go to? An expert in car mechanics, right? And humans are like that. Everyone is an expert in something or other. Now, what it looks like in our evolutionary history is that this emerges and becomes a key aspect of human evolution because of the information exchange that happens as a result of expertise. And what we think is that once populations get to a certain threshold of size, the information transfer from experts to non-experts becomes permanent. And so, of course, this is before writing and it's before noting things down. So in order for something to become permanent in a culture where there is no writing, you have to transfer that information to many people. So it looks like population explosions or population growth is absolutely crucial for our cognitive development. Otherwise, information just, you know, if I give a lecture to 10 people and those 10 people remember 1% of what I say, then by the time they get home, then that what I said to them is gone. But if I give a lecture to 100 people and 1% of those, 10% of that information is accurately transcribed into 1% of those people, then they might pass it on and the information begins to become permanent. And we think it's called demographic transition
That process is called demographic transition.
Well, the theory behind this is the demographic transition that occurred when we became behaviorally modern, so the full package of behavioral modernity, was a direct result of accurate transfer of information within groups, which is determined by the size of those groups. So that was a slightly technical answer to your question, but the answer is absolutely yes. We are collegial as a species, and it seems to be absolutely inherent to our evolution. And like I said at the beginning, to our evolution, which is away from biological evolution and towards social evolution. We haven't really biologically changed very much in about 200,000 to 300,000 years. There's some genetic changes which have great visible, made visible changes which are very apparent to us, such as about pigmentation. But for the most part, if you found someone from 300,000 years ago in Morocco, which is our oldest evidence for Homo sapiens, and you tidied them up and trimmed their beard and put them in a nice suit and sat them down next to you in a lecture theatre, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart from all of our other great humanist supporters.
You said a moment, I mean, you've just obviously you've just given a description of a process and a phenomenon, and it could be a very neutral description. But you said right at the beginning that this was an example of us unshackling ourselves from the constraints of evolution. And that sounds like you think this is a positive liberation as much as anything else. Is that because you do believe in human progress, you do think progress has occurred, that it's real, and you think that the state in which we are now, having moved away from what you describe as these constraints, is what we're liberated by it?
Well, I mean, there's a sort of inherent value judgment in answering that question, but I'm sort of okay to do it because it assumes...
Well, they are your words. That's what you said. You said we're unshackled from these constraints.
That's true. But the constraints, what I mean is the constraints of evolution are that evolution is brutal and biology is I'm not going to quote that terrible poem, which it will be on the tip of many of our listeners' tongues, but it's just not a good poem. But anyway, you know, it is brutal out there, and what we have done by deprogramming ourselves away from the biological evolution towards the social is that we have allowed ourselves the ability to develop technologies which allow the success or survival of people who otherwise would not have survived. And so there are costs associated with that: population explosion, technological development, which risks destroying both us and the rest of the planet.
It doesn't sound like such.
but on the other hand, it is what it is. There is.
So what are the benefits?
The benefits is that we're me and you are talking right now,
and we'd be dead otherwise.
And most of us wouldn't have made it past our first birthday, let alone our fifth. And there are billions of people alive who otherwise wouldn't have been alive. Now, again, there's a conversation that's about the size of the global population, which many people in Silicon Valley and since Malthus have been fretting about. But as a humanist, I take the view that we should do our best to... That those lives are as full and as healthy as possible, because it is what it is. We have built this world, and we have to deal with it.
Got to see it through, have we?
Yeah.
You feel a commitment to that? Do you feel a sort of human solidarity? I often wonder because people sometimes say that it's hard to feel imaginative solidarity with every human being, but I think that you feel. I think I feel it too, but I think you feel it.
I definitely do feel it, and I think that this plays into a lot of my work, especially when talking about concepts like eugenics.
I'd like to come on to that, yeah.
Well, I mean, the principles of eugenics really rely on a sort of mindset, which is that you don't care about other people as much, or that you're willing to rank people or discard people as being inferior to whoever you consider to be valid. And there's a nice Stephen Jay Gould quote about this when he was asked, which I quote quite often, which is he was asked about the concept of genius and the concept of high intelligence, and they were talking about Einstein and the value that we put on individuals who are significant people from history. And they were talking about, you know, if any value could be determined by looking at Einstein's brain, which clearly was quite a special brain. And Gould said, I am less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops. And I really love that as an idea, because it's a really important idea, because either we choose to rank people and fetishize people who are of great significance and discard the fact that their socioeconomic structures appear to be an emergent property of all societies, or we take the view that we wish to optimize the potential for as many people as possible. Someone the other day asked me if I prefer, this is a slight tangent, but I think it's related. Someone asked me if I prefer, knowing that I'm a big fan of Taylor Swift and also Charles Darwin, they said, which would you prefer, if you had to choose one, which would it be? Well, no, I didn't. Oof. It's an instant answer to me. And I think it shows the value of humankind in this answer. Darwin, who is I'm the ultimate Darwin fanboy, a genius and a generous and a kind-hearted man.
A good man.
some poor views on women, some typical views about race of his time. But otherwise, he was a good man. And we're very lucky in evolutionary biology that our figurehead wasn't a terrible human being. What he did...
You chose him, did you? Is that where you're going to come to?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
Of course I chose Taylor Swift. Oh. Because if you reran the tape of the universe again, then someone else would have discovered evolution by natural selection. In fact, we know that someone kind of did in Alfred Russel Wallace at roughly the same time, although his eight-page letter was somewhat insubstantial compared to what became The Origin of Species. But nature is out there to be discovered. And maybe it would have been 10 years, maybe it would have been 50 years, which would have been terrible for the history of science and progress and so on. But reality is there to be discovered. But no one, if you rerun the tape of the universe again, no one is ever going to write 1989 in the same way. And I know it sounds silly, but I do mean it. And I value that because that shows the true potential of humans more than Christ. Did I say that? More than Darwin?
Yeah, you did. I'm not sure you're right about that. I mean, because surely one of the values of Darwin isn't just that he discovered something that was out there waiting to be discovered, but the interpretation he put on it and the moment in which and the way he expressed it. I mean, imagine if the same facts had been discovered, you know, in a very different by someone with very different political views or of a very different character, they could have presented them in an entirely different way, which could have created a sort of much darker legacy or much darker scientific establishment, a much darker set of assumptions. I think science isn't just pure, is it? I mean, science isn't,
absolutely
science
not.
Isn't as separate from music, yeah, as you're implying.
No, science is always political and data is always, is never neutral. And I truly believe that as well, which I know some of the sciencey types listening will go, what did he just say?
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting question, and I will set this as a question for my new intake of students in a couple of weeks. Darwin was largely politically neutral, though. I mean, he was politically gentle, and he largely extracted himself from these sorts of conversations and let other people fight those battles for him. He's the application of some of the ideas that are within evolutionary theory, which were applied as the political ideology of eugenics. Well, they, of course, are grotesque. But, you know, that happened with Darwin.
Sure.
So, you know, not at his behest or with his blessing at all. I loathe the idea that there is a direct pathway from Darwin and evolutionary theory to, well, the Second World War and the gates of Auschwitz.
Mm.
Because it's not true and it's ahistorical and it simplifies a complex picture. But Darwin, for all his liberalism and his good mannishness, that still happened,
yeah,
whilst bastardizing some of the ideas that came, yeah, from his pen. Anyway.
And there'll be some bad covers of Taylor Swift in the years to come.
Yeah, but I don't know how to respond to that.
We may have sweated this as far as it could be sweated. The other thing that you've written about that's connected is racism. You've written about racism for adults, and you've written most recently a book for children as well.
Yeah.
The title of which is
Where Are You Really From?
Where Are You Really From? Which I love that question because, you know, I've seen so many people get asked that question at, you know, I remember the first time I heard a friend I was with be asked that question, and I thought, this is a bit odd. And then I didn't realise at the time it was just something people have all the time, you know, they're asked this,
yeah,
all the time.
It does happen all the time. So I'm not particularly dark-skinned, but I'm darker than your average person from Ipswich, born in 1975. And I've had that question asked to me 1,000 times. And interestingly, maybe it's because I'm more alert to it, or maybe because the political tone in this country has changed in the last few years, but there have been other examples where I thought, God, that you did ask, you just asked me a question like that. So I'm mixed race in that my mother was Indian and my dad is English. And a funny thing happened last year. Three different women referred to me as exotic. Yeah, and I thought that's a funny, in reference to my ancestry, and it's a funny sort of thing to hear, and I also think that it's, I know they're trying to be charming,
Are they? Is that a charming thing to say?
I think so, but I think it is. I think they were.
Because it's really just a, you know, synonym for foreign.
Yes. Yes. So that's exactly right. One of the people who asked me this, she spends a lot of time doing charity work in India, and she kept referring to the exotic young men that she worked with. And it was peculiar, to say the least. But I think it's on a similar sort of spectrum of that question. Yes, but where are you really from? It's a nice way to frame a book, because it's a nonsensical question and it doesn't take any...
Well, let's come to that. So my question is, why is it racism that you've taken such aim at? I mean, it probably connects with your science, but there are also probably ethical and maybe personal reasons why you've made this the social prejudice that you want to target through your work.
Yeah, a sort of funny inevitability that comes in three directions. The first is that I am mixed race, and so I have experienced a low level, but a measurable level of racism in my life, and certainly not in any way, because I come from a relatively privileged background, being male and middle class, and going to, you know, University College London, places like that. Nevertheless, I'm quite a punchy individual, and that sort of experience drives a big fight. So that's one. The second is that I then studied genetics, and without really knowing, I didn't study genetics because of its close ties with the evolution of scientific racism, but those two things are definitely true. The birth of biology was not in parallel with the birth of scientific racism or European expansion. It was in service of European expansion and scientific racism. So the very roots of the field that I've devoted my life to were in service of a political ideology, which we now and I find hateful. So there's sort of inevitability that there's two things there. The first two, me being mixed race and experiencing racism, and secondly, the field that I have devoted my life to, it was born of scientific racism. And then the third thing is that the trajectory of that field, it's the only field which has dismantled the biological concept of race, and therefore has contributed, that trajectory is celebratory. We have a pernicious history, but a celebratory trajectory of that field. There's a minor reason as well within all of that, which is I studied at UCL, which is where so much of this work was done in history. So it's only a few generations back, two or three generations from me, where lots of the eugenics and scientific racism work was done in my department. And so it was almost inevitable that, I mean, I would have had to have fought quite hard not to end up writing about race and genetics and science. And my interest in history, it coagulates around that, which is where that book came from. The genesis of the eugenics book was similar, because eugenics is similar but different. But it's another example of how an academic field that I'm very closely wedded to, that is genetics, emerges specifically in service of the political ideology of eugenics, rather than the other way around, which is what I think a lot of people think. So psychology, stats, psychology, statistics, a lot of aspects of medicine and genetics itself, all were born as means of addressing questions that were almost universally popular at the time, late Victorian, early Edwardian, which were population control and eugenics.
But do you think it's science that will help to end racism? Do you think that science has as much a part to play as our own moral development?
I think that bigotry is permanent, it seems. And though the arc of history is towards progress, I think it probably is. I think we're undergoing a blip here, I suspect. I think that the longer view of the history of scientific racism and science more broadly shows that things that were acceptable 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago are no longer acceptable today, and that the permanence of concepts like race is not really present in when you look at history through scientific history through time. So the invention of race in the 17th and 18th century, the versions of race that we adhere to today largely through social construction, didn't really exist before that. And so I think that knowing that and knowing the reasons why that is the case and why genetics has dismantled the biological concept of race today means that we can at least say with confidence that science does not support scientific or racist ideologies. And whilst being knowledgeable about those ideas will not fix racism, it does mean that you can't, if you're a racist, you can't have my tools to justify your bigotry. You're going to have to find other ways to support your hatred, because my work and the work of thousands of women and men all around the world for the last 100 years or so says that the things that you asserted are incorrect. What's really interesting, though, in the last few years is the resurgence of those ideas in new forms. And that's kind of why I wrote that book at this time, and the eugenics book as well, because I think that if you're in genetics, none of the things I say are controversial or new. But I don't think we really did a good job of conveying this to a broader public, because I think they're very, biology is very experiential. And again, you know, Jim can point at stars a million miles away and say, that's a supernova, and you don't know, and I don't know, and, you know, we can't even see that shit, and, or that this table's made of quantum stuff. And I'm like, sure, whatever, I don't know. But if I tell you that your children's eye color is going to be different, well, I don't know how to predict your children's eye color based on your own eye color, or the reason you behave in this particular way is probably nothing to do with the genetics or who your parents were, then people go, I am, because I live in a family and stuff like that. So we're contesting 10,000 years of sort of cultural baggage with some modern DNA. It's quite hard work, but it's fun, though.
Wandering into science, realizing how little we know, the importance of stories, connecting with each other, strengthening groups, and unshackling ourselves from the constraints of evolution. Thank you, Adam, for telling us what you believe.
Well, thank you, Andrew.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. We'll be releasing new episodes every Thursday. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK, and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.